Hello, and welcome back to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and this is where we talk about issues that are important to people with chronic illness or with disabilities. And today we're going to talk about chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is a word that's evolving. It's meant something in the past. It still means that, but it's adding new meanings. Let me explain. Chemotherapy is basically the use of chemicals to treat disease. And obviously, there's a very long history of doing that. The treatment of syphilis with arsenic, the treatment of many diseases with different chemicals. But what it has come to mean in most of our minds is the treatment of cancer with very strong chemicals, let's face it, poisons. Poisons that are intended to kill the cancer and hopefully before they kill you. They have a very heavy impact in the body. They're not specific, they're not precise in the way that they attack disease. The newer chemotherapy drugs are learning to be much more specific. We're understanding better how things specifically work in the cell and designing drugs to go and target a particular process within the cell. So as we learn to do that, the drugs become much more specific in their intentions. But at the same time, there still are side effects. There are not only the intended results, there may be some unintended results that make you uncomfortable in one way or another. So there's the direct effect and the side effect that we need to be concerned with. Stay with us now for a very interesting discussion of chemotherapy and clinical trials. We'll take a little break here, and I'll be right back to introduce our guest, Rena Blumberg-Olshansky. The Powerful Patient is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We welcome your questions either by email to questions@powerfulpatient.org or by telephone at 1-800-767-4845, extension 6. Thank you. The traditional chemotherapies that were used 30 years ago were referred to by one doctor as using a sledgehammer kind of approach. You use this sledgehammer on the body so that you not only are targeting the disease, but you're also going to injure a lot of other cells while you're doing it. Obviously, the most common side effect that we're familiar with is that you often lose your hair. Why do you lose your hair? Because these chemicals are targeting fast-growing cells on the theory that the cancer cells are the ones that are reproducing most frequently. So it targets the cells that reproduce most frequently in our bodies, which are indeed the cancer cells. But in addition to that, our hair follicles are always replacing themselves, and also the lining of our stomachs is constantly replacing itself. So those cell types in particular can be injured by the chemotherapy drugs, meaning that you not only have the effect that attacks the disease that we're talking about, in addition to that, you're going to have some what are referred to as side effects, other effects that are not so desirable, but that kind of come with the package. You can't get the anti-disease benefit without also having the side effects. Now, over the years, we've learned to manage some of the side effects a great deal better than the description you're going to hear in today's speaker. But nonetheless, they are still very much there. And so whenever anybody is entering into a course of chemotherapy, we need to think not only of the therapeutic benefit, what are the pluses that are going to come out of this experience, but also what are the side effects that go with this package, and how are we going to manage the side effects, and will they truly be tolerable? So signing up for chemotherapy is not an easy decision. Often it is the only decision because it's the only life-saving benefit that can be found at the time. If your doctor suggests a course of chemotherapy, you need to sit down with the doctor and have a very frank discussion about the pluses and the minuses. What are the benefits that we can expect, and what are the side effects, the not so desirable outcomes of having this therapy? How long is it going to go on? What is the way that it's administered? How often do you have to come in for treatment, or can you take the treatment at home with pills? And there are more options now than there have been before. So let's back up for a minute and talk about cancer and why we need chemotherapy at all. Cancer is a disease that is characterized by the runaway replication of cells. So it's cell growth out of control. That's the primary definition of cancer. But in addition to that, the nastiest aspect of cancer is that it can propagate to other parts of the body. It can do what's called metastasis. If it metastasizes, what it means is it throws off cells from the primary tumor that go into the bloodstream or the lymphatic system and can travel to another part of your body and plant themselves into another organ. So, for example, kidney cancer cells might travel and become a tumor in the brain or a metastasis in the brain. And it's that remote site cancer that is the most to be feared here. That's the most dangerous kind. Once it starts escaping and going into other parts of your body, then it's an all-out war to try to find and stop the cancer cells. Cancers don't start out being as big as a grapefruit, though. Cancers begin by being smaller than the size of a pin. So if you remember that cancer begins in one cell, and from that one cell becomes many cells, and it can take 6 months or a year to even become the size of the tip of a ballpoint pen. And during the course of that year, 2 years, 5 years, before the tumor is ever even seen, during that time, our bodies actually take care of most of the tiny little things that might have grown up to be cancers. And it's keeping our bodies strong so that they can defeat those early stage cancers. That's the most important thing of all. So that's when we talk about nutrition for cancer prevention, managing stress, making sure that stress doesn't become overwhelming and begin to depreciate your immune system. So keep that immune system strong so that it can go attack those incipient cancers, those little teeny tiny things that might grow up to be a cancer. That's the very best time and place to really defeat cancer. If you can do it at those very early stages, before you're even aware that there's a cancer in your body, before it becomes a tumor, that's the best time and place to do it. Okay, so now let's say that that didn't occur. For some reason, this tumor has grown now to a size where it's noticed. Either you notice it or your doctor notices it on some scan, and now you have a tumor to be dealt with. In most cases, if you can catch the tumor small before it gets to be 2 or 3 centimeters, so in other words, it's smaller than an inch. If it's smaller than an inch, then frequently the tumor can be removed, and that may be the end of the story. But that may also not be the end of the story. There may be more. And the trick now is to determine whether, by removing that tumor, we've gotten it all. In breast cancer, this is referred to as a lumpectomy. So we take out the lump, we take out the tumor, and then is it that, or is it not, the end of the story? One of the things they do now in breast cancer is that they can actually trace the lymph node to which this tumor drains. So a tumor has a particular connection, if you will, to a lymph node, and it will exchange fluids with a particular lymph node. It used to be that they would take out multiple lymph nodes, just kind of hunt and peck it around to try to figure out which one of those lymph nodes might also have a cancer cell or two in it. Nowadays, they can much more specifically trace back and determine which of the lymph nodes this particular tumor is communicating with, check that lymph node, and if it is clear, then the likelihood is that all the other lymph nodes will be clear. So we've learned a lot in the last 30 years. But the lady we're going to meet today, whose name is Rena Blumberg Olshansky, Rena had breast cancer in 1975. She had a course of chemotherapy beginning in 1977. And this is the same era when I had breast cancer many years ago. And 30 years ago, the prospects for people with breast cancer were not as good as they are today. So some of what you will hear is older information, and we'll explain to you a little bit about how that information may have changed. But what I want you particularly to listen for in this interview is the courage that it took to engage in what then was a clinical trial. It was a new drug. They didn't know if it was going to help. They didn't know how it was going to help. The treatment was very rugged. It was a two-year engagement in having this chemotherapy drug 1 week out of four and undergoing tremendous side effects for 2 years. So that was a huge undertaking. It took a lot of courage on her part to participate in it. She didn't know whether it was actually going to help her or not. As a matter of fact, when she first agreed to participate in the trial, she didn't know which of two drugs she was going to receive. And there was no data, certainly no long-term data, on this drug to determine whether it might help her for a while and then maybe something else would occur as a result of the drug. You never quite know when you're taking part in a clinical trial. And yet for her, it was the best choice at the time to ensure that she would be there to raise her children and to enjoy life. So I'd like you to meet Rena Blumberg Olshansky, who wrote a book called Headstrong. And she wrote this book in 1981 to talk about her experience with breast cancer and chemotherapy. By way of introduction, let me read to you an excerpt from the preface to this book. It's entitled Headstrong, A Story of Conquests and Celebrations Living Through Chemotherapy by Rena Blumberg. Today, it has been 5 years since I had my mastectomy. This is considered the first benchmark for optimism for the possibility of a normal lifespan. Medically, 10 years are now required for clinical pronouncement of cure. But I feel well, and my doctors confirm this, and my fears are behind me. During my illness, many people were amazed and puzzled by my energetic immersion in celebrating every day. They would ask, "How do you do it? How do you find the energy? How do you keep from quitting chemo? How do you deal with your family? How do you continue to work?" Sometimes they asked for themselves, sometimes for a close friend or a relative. They wanted details, minutiae. They wanted to know how I dealt with the physical problems of surgery and therapy, the emotional problems of sex and relating to my family, and the everyday problems of life, work, friendships, activities. After many hours of personal conversations and public lectures, I've decided to write about my experiences and share with others the discoveries I have made. Very early on in the writing of this book, I decided to entitle it Headstrong. One definition of headstrong is an inclination to have one's own way. Many people might say this is not necessarily an acceptable attitude. In still other ways, the word headstrong has the even more negative connotation of extreme willfulness and sometimes obstinacy. But here, without changing the basic strength of that word, I mean headstrong in a very positive sense. For me, having my own way meant that I was going to survive, to live, and to live fully. This took willfulness, to be sure, and at certain moments, particularly during chemo, yes, it took downright obstinacy. But more than any other attitude, I feel this headstrong approach to coping with cancer was the quality that allowed me to survive and to get on with the business of living and living joyously. So here is my story, my headstrong story. And we're going to hear directly from Rena Blumberg Olshansky.
When I wrote Headstrong, Crown Publishers published 25,000 of them.
Yeah.
And they sold out. Then I was lecturing with Bernie Siegel, with other people on survival and wellness, and people kept asking for the book. So I raised money to have it published. Crown gave me a release because I gave all the money to the Cancer Society, mm-hmm. and we gave away 15,000 books at Susan Komen runs and at other places to share the message in paperback. The message was what I wanted to get out.
Right.
And when somebody's sick, I try to get it to sort of tell them, hey, you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine.
So tell me your story.
I come from Cleveland. For 28 years, I was a radio broadcaster on a group of stations that started with two and went all the way up and were sold to Clear Channel in 1999. Mm-hmm. I did interviews the way we're having a conversation and tried to lift people's spirits, let them know what was happening as the city made a comeback. And in general, it was like college without walls. Mm-hmm. I observed everything from heart surgery, open heart surgery, to famous authors and poets, to people who made a difference, brave people. And it was just a wonderful, joyous experience. I retired when I moved to Boston. I've been on a honeymoon for the last 8 years. I married a man from Boston and moved here. Now, it helped that I had a daughter here with three children.
Yes.
But so we now have a combined family of six children and 13 grandchildren.
Oh, wonderful. That's great. So then you had an adventure with cancer yourself.
Right. In 1975... I had a mammogram, and cancer was discovered, and I had, well, what they now call a lumpectomy. Mm-hmm. And there was a big decision made whether I should have chemo or not. There wasn't very much to take, or whether I should have a mastectomy. And after consulting with three different doctors, they said, no, we've got it, go on. Mm-hmm. Well, as often happens, we've learned later, 2 years later, it came back. And it had spread in 1977. Mm-hmm. And so I went into the NSABP protocol, the tamoxifen experiment. Mm-hmm. And for 2 years, I took really, really tough chemo. I mean, amazingly tough compared to what it is now. We, you know, sort of were randomized and agreed to experiment so people could live. By the time the 2 years was over, they were giving it to people right away. They didn't wait any longer period because they saw the results were good. Mm-hmm. And to be truthful, I always felt like I made a little bit of a difference because people who got breast cancer when I did who didn't have this have passed away. Mm-hmm. So it was lucky timing. And then in 1996, I got another cancer. It was a brand new one. It was another breast. And so this time I had a lumpectomy and radiation. And tamoxifen, ironically. So my story is one of just believing that you push and you keep living every day just as completely as you can. I sign everything in celebration with my name because the title of the book was Headstrong, A Story of Conquests and Celebrations, Living Through Chemotherapy. What would you do with your life afterwards? Your relationships, your choices, all the things that you do to make a life precious.
It changes your perspective on life.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Tell me how your perspective shifted.
It gave me an immediacy about life. First of all, you do live in the moment, and you do, everything is sweet. A day that's beautiful, a sunrise, a flower that blooms. I'm not kidding. Everything looks beautiful. Mm-hmm. Second of all, I sort of was always talking to God, you know, if you just let me live, believe me, I'll pay it forward. I will be kind to people. I will help them. You promise away your whole life that if you could buy a little time. And I really have spent my life conscious that every day I must reach out to someone, whether I visit them, call them, write to them. It's a covenant I made and I've never broken. I sort of call it 4 to 4 o'clock kindness. because I stop in the afternoon to make sure that I have done something. And if I'm going to be busy at 4 o'clock and I see my schedule's crowded, then I will make sure I program in an act of remembrance. So I've been doing that for 30 years.
That's very sweet. So your three bouts with cancer were in
75, 77, and 96.
And you had small children around in there, too.
I had a young child who was 8 at the time, and my other two children were 10 and 12 years older. And it has not been a smooth path. As anybody who's had cancer and chemo knows, I just last year had 5 surgeries. I had a shoulder replacement, and I've had got a new fixing in my esophagus and fixing in my stomach. When you've taken a lot of chemo for an extended period of time, things happen to you, orthopedically and every other way. So you learn not to complain. You know you keep your eye on the target, and you manage it.
Right. So chemotherapy was a way of killing the cancer cells that were potentially going to cause you a problem at that time.
They were going to take my life because they had already gone into another stage.
Right, and if they'd been propagated throughout your body, it would have been a much worse game than you were playing with the one tumor that had been found. But as you say, those early treatments were very rugged, and you were on it for 2 years?
Yeah.
Wow. And, like, what was the experience like? Sometimes they say, oh, you'll feel like maybe you have the flu.
No. That's a mild part. I was really sick and really swollen. All of us were. You had injection. You didn't have a port then, so you had it in a different vein in your hand every day for 5 days in a row, then a few weeks off, and again, you were really sick. It was a systemic sickness. It was the flu to a power of 100. You were really sick. And I worked. I worked through it.
So you managed to keep working?
I did.
Wow.
I had an aunt and uncle who drove me to therapy because I just didn't feel so well, but I did it in the afternoon. And I managed to keep working, and the same with radiation. With radiation, I drove myself every day and did the standard course. But back 30 years ago, things, they didn't know what they know now. They also didn't have Zofran. They didn't have the anti-nausea drugs. There's a lot people take for granted that wasn't there.
We now have drugs that can help to manage some of the side effects of chemotherapy. Let's take a little break here, and we'll be right back to talk some more with Rena about her cancer experience in 1975 and 77 when she had chemotherapy, and in 1996 when she had radiation therapy for breast cancer.
This is Keith Richards, a.k.a. Just Saying. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine. But it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
We're back now speaking with Rena Blumberg-Olshansky about having cancer in the 1970s.
People didn't talk about cancer. I came right after Happy Rockefeller and Betty Ford had breast cancer. Mm-hmm. I had been working on women's issues, and we had the International Year of the Woman, and Betty Ford came to Cleveland. People were just beginning to talk about it. I knew people who wouldn't tell that they had it because they were afraid they'd lose their jobs.
Yes.
And I think AIDS changed our outlook on cancer. At that point, if you got cancer, you were gone. And I think people now understand that you will live, you will be treated, and you will survive. And AIDS moved the fear a bit and the belief that, yes, this was curable.
Right, and in the 70s, you weren't supposed to talk about the word breast in a public place.
No, never.
I remember, Jack Parr got fired for saying the word thigh on television?
Right.
So
it was a very much more, inhibited time, private time. And as a broadcaster, I made a conscious decision to be open about what happened so that others would learn. And I was I was doing work with the Cancer Society. I worked to set up hospice of the Western Reserve when I realized what was happening to people. I was part of that. There was a lot of good support happening, really good support.
Right. And I remember when Shirley Temple Black went public with her breast cancer.
Right.
And talked about that on television. I think that's one of the things that broke the barrier on saying the word breast out loud.
Right. But people now, with the changed rules and what's permitted in the Fourth Estate, forget how it was.
Right.
And I'm glad to talk to you to remind people we're all pretty lucky now, because if you catch something early, the whole question now is early detection.
Yes.
If you have the luck to catch something, then you really have an arsenal to pick from. And it's because people gave their lives experimenting and trying.
That's right. And you were one of those early pioneers with treatments that at the time were much more rugged than what we're going through
today. It's much more civilized now.
Right.
It really is.
So
and the result is the same, by the way.
Right. But today the chemotherapies are a little more specific and not as lousy side effects as they used to be.
Right. But they can target it more and they know how to.
That's
we had no bone marrow transfers then. There were none of those things available. We lost people that we might not have. And so this is a time when also you can get more information, probably more than you need. You need a doctor's guidance with it.
Right.
But you also need friends around. There's some things that haven't changed. You need a support network,
yes.
Whether it's family of choice or your own family. You need people who will help you through so that you can hold your head up with dignity.
Having people around you who have been through what you've been through, and also friends and family, are extremely important in maintaining your sanity and keeping going. One of the portions of Rena's book that I particularly would like to share with you is her discussion about the checkup crazies. When you're anticipating a checkup, it can really wreak havoc with your mood and the way you may interact with people around you. So you need people who are going to understand the checkup crazies. Here's a quote beginning on page 83. The first days every 6 months before checkups for recurrence of cancer are a continuing source of tremendous stress. I call the symptoms of the stress the checkup crazies. It's a rational anxiety and is easily recognizable. It's a strange, recurring, common malady for anyone who has confronted major illness. The symptoms include waking up at 3 or 4 a.m., often with nightmares, shortness of breath, binging on food or not eating at all, fatigue, loss of temper, occasionally diarrhea, and usually teariness at unexpected moments. My symptoms also include more frenzied activities such as obsessive closet cleaning. This group of symptoms are readily recognized by those who've experienced them. It's the fear that tomorrow you may have a bad diagnosis. Basically, understanding the problem is the key to treating it and reinstating balance. At the time of subsequent checkups or doctor's visits, people with chronic illness experience the same trauma they had at the original discovery of the illness. The response to that memory causes extreme anxiety, and it must be dealt with and neutralized. I have checkups every 6 months, or more frequently if I observe a frightening body change, and I almost always have a case of the checkup crazies. However, with Dr. Hazelton's help, I have learned some positive ways to deal with my anxiety. First, I schedule my doctor's appointments at a time far in advance so that I can allow for several hours at the hospital in case a test is late or needs to be repeated. I get hold of a good book and I save it for the waiting hours. This way, I use the time for my own pleasure, and I also divert my attention from all the patients around me in the testing area who are replete with IVs, drainage bags, and signs of physical deterioration. Since I know I identify with them and I get fearful, I pre-plan my protection and diversion. I have found it helps to make a point of talking to the people who are testing me. Somehow, this contact lessens the impersonality of the tests and infuses this cold situation with humanity and reduces stress. If I'm having a bone or liver scan, which are particularly frightening to me, I use meditation or trance learned in hypnotherapy to relax myself. A touch of trance, being transported to a safe, comfortable, optimistic place in my consciousness, brings relaxation and the reduction of my raw fear. I also try to have my work organized and finished well ahead of time. I tape extra radio programs and schedule other activities so I can make the 2 days of testing a mini holiday. If I find I'm not as patient and tolerant at home or at the office, I joke and honestly apologize by saying the truth. I'm having the checkup crazies. I'm extremely lucky to have doctors who are kind and considerate and call me at the end of a day's testing with the results. If you know your physician well, you can phone him and let him know that this is your testing period and that you'd like your results as soon as possible. By alerting him, you will help single yourself out from his patient load, and he will make an extra effort to get you your results quickly. Each day you wait for the results is almost always another night's sleep lost. Not only will it make you crazy, it can also affect your health. Calling ahead and getting information as quickly as possible is a large part of making a plan for your improved personal protection. The checkup crazies are almost impossible to avoid if you are afflicted with chronic illness, but acknowledging that you are afraid and making strides toward dealing with the anxiety will go a long way toward conquering them. Let's take a little break here, and we'll be back right after the break to talk more with Rena.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back. We're here speaking with Rena Blumberg-Olshansky about her book, Headstrong, which chronicles her experience with breast cancer and chemotherapy in the 1970s. It also, I have to say, includes a lot of wonderful wisdom that's truly timeless about managing your fears, managing your disease, and coming through it in good shape.
Some people need more data than others. I should say there's tons of data now on the internet, but it's very hard sometimes to sift through that.
You're absolutely right, and the doctors ask you sometimes not to, because you come up with the wrong information because you're reading everybody else's information and you don't know. There's no monolithic cancer. There's 40 different kinds.
Right. It's hundreds of different diseases.
Right.
And also the grade of the disease. And depending on how far along you are in the process, the treatment suggestions will be different.
Also then, I almost missed it, they were able to test receptors just beginning so that you would know what would even work on your cancer. I mean, it was
right.
So... 30 years is a long time in the history of contemporary medicine, right. Although it's a short time in the overall course of it. There's so many discoveries where you can go direct and targeted and really sustain a person. The whole message I ever want to get out, the powerful part of it, is that people will survive.
Yes. Yes, and that there are many options now to be considered. But what you have to do is sit down with your own medical team and say, what are the options for me?
The word you use is really important. You need a team. Because you have different kinds of doctors who are going to come in your life to sustain you, you need one primary care physician, and then you do need a team of. And if you live in this area, it is unbelievable what's available. really remarkable.
We live in Boston, which is a very rich medical market. Some people live in backwoodsy Idaho or something.
Then
they don't have as many doctors around them, but they still have that same spectrum of choices. Maybe
right.
Not as much guidance at hand to help them through that.
But they also, if they have rare forms, I know people who've come, when you have a rare form, you find the doctor who's doing the life-saving surgery and techniques, and you can go to that doctor.
Right.
Or you really, if you do the research now, we are one people united by the Internet medically.
Right, and I thought it was very interesting that Ted Kennedy, who also lives in Boston, went to Duke University to have his surgery.
You
find the specialist who's working on your particular form of cancer who might be able to add some particular value.
Right, and it casts no aspersions because a doctor who saved his daughter, there's a man in Boston who saves people from a specific kind of lung cancer. His name is Sugar Baker. I know people who've come from another city to him and been saved. So it goes to where there's centers of excellence in America, and there are a lot in the tertiary care centers. What people need to do is, after they get over hearing the word and a moment of, why me, and a moment of fear, then they have to pull themselves together and say, okay, I have to be my primary researcher, and I have to go to work to figure out how to live. And nobody's going to do it for you. You've got to do it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Or in cases, if it's a child, then the parents have to go into action.
Right. And with all the professionals around us, it sometimes feels like we shouldn't have to do the research, and yet there's a value in doing your own research. Tell me about your own decision to make your research and what you found was particularly valuable for you.
Well, there were a lot of different points, but if I had to be randomized in the experiment, I had a team that stayed with me all my life because of this experiment I was in, and they followed things that happened to me. That research went on until a couple years ago.
The National Surgical Adjuvant Breast Program, or NSABP, was an experiment that began with the clinical trial that Rena participated in and continued, as she said, for many decades following that experience, because they wanted to determine over the long haul whether these drugs, in fact, extended the life of the people that were treated. So the experiment was not just about the duration of the trial while people were on it for 2 years, but they want 5-year follow-up data and 10-year follow-up data to try to find out exactly how much benefit was accrued from the taking of this drug.
So being randomized means that you don't know when you go into the trial whether you're actually going to get the drug or
not.
No,
and that's a terrible choice to have to make. But if you're going to have scientific research, then that's the way it's done. If they find there's a reason to take you out, they do. But otherwise, it's a decision you make for learning.
Basically, they're comparing one course of treatment with another. So if you're on course of treatment A versus B, then we'll see how the two groups do. If the differences are clear, let's say that group A is doing 4 times better than group B, then usually they will go ahead and just switch everybody onto the better drug. It gives you an opportunity for what they call crossover. You can cross over to the other arm of the study. But unless the distinctions are really clear like that, then they may not offer that. One of the things that sometimes becomes clear is that there is very little difference between taking the drug and not taking the drug, or taking drug A versus taking drug B. And that is, of course, the objective of the study, is to find out if there is a significant difference, and if so, what is that significant difference?
But there were other decisions. Reconstruction.
Yep.
How are you going to do it? Are you going to use your body parts? Are you going to use other things? I waited 7 years until I found the solution that was right for me and the person that was right for me.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of research along the way. And reconstruction now is to the power of bazillion over what it was because of the new microsurgery and the other things. It's much better. There aren't side effect problems. So each way, it's not like you make one decision. There's a whole lot that comes sequentially to keep you alive. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing is that there's support networks to talk to, people who've been in your shoes. And they know, and they're willing to talk. Yeah. I mean, today I had a conversation with someone who's all burned from radiation. Well, she'll be fine in a couple of weeks. But I've been there. I could say that to her.
Right. But that is one of those stages that we go through with radiation.
Right. And I had to be taking off 12 days to heal. I said to her, you haven't failed. You haven't done anything wrong. That's where human beings come into effect.
Right.
I also want to tell you that nurses are fabulous. A doctor takes care of you, and he sort of gives you opinion. He walks away. The nurses stay with you, and they really help, and they have a lot of experience. And I cannot praise nurses enough for the care they've given me through my life.
Right, and so many volunteer organizations now where they connect patients, as you were describing, a patient who's been through this with someone who's going through it now, and so that they can share experiences.
Yeah, lots of times they ask you if you'll be willing to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are surviving and you're okay, then you're very glad to turn around and do it because someone did it for you.
Yes.
Part of it is human connection. I don't think, you know, you talk about your title, powerful patient. I think a powerful patient is empowered by the people who love them and who care for them and who surround them with support.
For sure. Now, we were talking about doing your own research. What do you think is the particular value in your doing the research as opposed to relying on someone else to do that research for you?
I think you need it done both ways, but I think you can ask more intelligent questions.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know options. You need to know possibilities. And I think you can have a better range of questions.
Right.
I think you need both.
Right, and it doesn't mean, you know, going down to the library and doing primary research anymore. It may
no.
be just poking around on the Internet and reading some articles and talking with some organizations.
Also, you call the support organizations. They put you in touch with people. Research is not only Internet. It's not only words. It's people.
Yes.
And that's where I've gotten a lot of my best information. I mean, when women are undergoing reconstruction, they'll go in the bathroom and open their shirt and show you what it looks like, show you this person's work. Yeah, I mean, someone who would never unbutton the top button will help you. And it sounds wild, but that's how you, I mean, you learn from the very esoteric to the very practical.
Right, it becomes a very important sisterhood when you share that with someone.
Absolutely.
You're willing to go that extra mile for them.
Right.
Right. And I remember when I had breast cancer in 1977 and I was working in a volunteer agency. One of the volunteers pulled me aside and she said, I just wanted you to know I'm 25 years out from a mastectomy. And I burst into tears and I said, that's the best gift anybody could have given me.
Yeah, it's nice. In 1977, people weren't saying that.
That's right.
So that's a lovely gift.
Yeah.
So you have survived how long?
Well, it's since 77. How long is that?
Huh?
So it's, what, 30 years, yeah.
So we are sisters in
that
respect.
That's right, right.
That's very nice. Very nice. Congratulations.
And, you know, we chose different paths, but we also, evidently, my disease was not as far progressed as what you were dealing with.
But I also have a very close friend who, at the same time, in 77, had a lumpectomy, which was just a new word.
Yeah.
And we measured our survival together.
Mm-hmm.
I have another friend who got it at the same time who took a different course of chemo. We have measured our survivals together. That's really been an interesting phenomenon. Now, she had, from the radiation, enormous swelling, and she happens to wear a Job's sleeve. Nobody's without a complication, but here we were three women undergoing something at the same time, all of whom have survived with a different path.
That's
which
great.
Is important to know there's no one right way to treat everybody.
Right, right. And I had a modified radical mastectomy, so that I don't know if that's a third or fourth path in your group. But as you say, everybody's slightly different, and everybody has their own considerations, too, about the path that they're willing to take.
And there's a whole question of sexuality involved with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something I've learned to be sensitive to for people.
Go ahead.
And it needs to be discussed that there are difficulties that come with this, and partners need to be understanding. Some get affected badly.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned to be sensitive to people's needs and to say, is everything okay? How you doing?
Mm-hmm.
In a, you know, where you would not normally walk up and ask people about these things. But
right,
so
that it can affect your self-esteem and the way you feel about your body, but it can also affect your partner and the way your partner sees
your body. So this is an issue of great importance. And it's also part of your strengthening. You are more than the sum of your breasts. You are a human being with enormous resources, and you have to reconfigure who you are, what's important, what you stand for.
Right. And I think women today have more of a general self-esteem than 30 years ago, so it's a little bit easier, but nonetheless, it's still a very big issue.
They do. But it's a very private and personal thing, but it's very present when it's happening to you.
Right.
Everybody says, I love you, it doesn't matter. Well, by God, in a lot of cases, it does matter. It does make a difference. There's impotence that happens because of it. There's strained relationships. So people need to be sensitive that you have to make your own power from within. And that takes some doing after a while.
In the book, Rena shares her feelings openly about the changes that were happening to her body. In 1975, when she had the lumpectomy, she talks about waking up. When I did wake up from the surgery, I thought the scars I would have from removing 3 tiny little growths would be minimal, that my breast would look pretty much the same as it did before the surgery. I didn't have much, but at least what I had was well formed. Not so. I wasn't prepared for the ugliness of my breast or the dramatic change in its configuration. The nipple was in the wrong place. I felt misshapen and mutilated. When Dr. Sachs told me after surgery that the breast looked beautiful, I suppose from a surgeon's point of view, I decided that from a woman's point of view that the man was crazy. He found it hard to understand my reaction. And later, when she was due to go back for another checkup, she talks about the fear for doing it. In the midst of preparation for a major event that I was chairing, came the reminder card for my annual OBGYN checkup and mammogram. I remembered my friend and shivered when I saw the little white card drop out of the fall clothing catalog on a hot afternoon in August. I told myself that making the appointment wasn't urgent, that Jewish women for some reason didn't usually get cancer of the cervix, that people in my family generally died of heart attacks, all kinds of rationalizations. Plus, I was scared. I didn't call for an appointment until all the preparations for the party were complete. And when she finally gets to the doctor, he palpates the good right breast and then moved to the left, the ugly, misshapen one. Suddenly, his banter ceased. He frowned as he examined the left side. He seemed to pale. He lowered his voice and told me exactly what he felt and observed. The left breast contained a large lump, and the nipple was inverted. God knows I should have noticed the changes in that awful, unsightly left breast. I had experienced the fear of cancer, and I knew about the benefits of early detection because of my lumpectomy 2 years before. I had devoted airtime to the subject. I, of all people, should have been aware. But I never examined the left breast after the lumpectomy. I had a horror of touching it, let alone looking at it. I had a hang-up about my appearance, and that hang-up nearly cost me my life. She talks about her husband's feelings as well. My husband's feelings about what was happening to me during these few days between detection and surgery were hard to discern. He was shocked, of course, and very worried about me, but I think he was also angry with me. I was the compulsive, careful one. I had done much research on breast cancer. How could I have been so careless about noticing the changes on the left side? He never shared any of his thoughts with me then, only later as I began to write this book. So we all have our own private fears, and even those of us who have done the research, who have intellectually accepted that things need to be monitored, it still is difficult to go through that monitoring. It still is difficult to face our fears and our mortality.
So tell me more about your conquests and celebrations as a result of your...
My life has been spectacular. I've had a wonderful life of work. I was lucky to be part of the Cleveland community as it rebuilt itself. And... came together. I, with a nun, helped create a crisis nursery, which we've worked together 28 years, Providence House, for babies abused, abandoned, and at risk from birth to six, and it's become a village. I was able to help build Playhouse Square Foundation, which is the second largest performing arts center in America. And I was able to be enlisted as a citizen of a city, and that was exciting. I think had I not had cancer, I might not have been as believable and as credible when I went out to speak. I'm not tall and thin and gorgeous. I'm a short lady. And I was believable because I was always dieting, because I was always striving. So people could identify with the reality of my life. And the reality was I believed in things. I was able to get out and do something. And I think when you've had cancer, there is an immediacy, an effort, and a drive. There isn't, you don't sit around and wait for a lot of tomorrows. I did a television series for a CBS station, and it was called One More Tomorrow. Well, you squeeze everything out of you can out of one day, then you go on to the next day. Mm-hmm. But you set agendas, you set personal things you want to do. I don't think anybody's the same afterwards, and I think sometimes this can be turned into a blessing, a focus.
And as you say, none of us has a guarantee on tomorrow. We don't know what the next day, month, year is going to bring. And yet when you have cancer, it makes that very real in a different way.
Every time you go for treatment and you see all those sick people, you say, this is not me. And
right.
I would put on makeup and I would wear big flowers on my face. I mean, I wanted to come in. I wear outrageous, wonderful colors all the time. I really, it's right in your face. I mean, I am not a sick person. Even when I am, I pop on a hat and keep going. But I think it gives you an incentive to push for the most you can be.
Yes. Yes. And to make the most of every day that we're given.
Right. And also, keep all your relationships current, since you never do know what's going to happen. If there's something to be said to make up, to make peace, to move a relationship along, do it.
Right. Right. Harboring those grudges doesn't do anybody any good.
No. It only makes you sick.
Yeah, it makes you sick and it breeds regret.
Also, I do use heaving tapes. A friend of mine, Belruth Napersack, has developed a whole line of tapes called guided imagery. Called health journeys. And I recommend doing that after you've had your therapies to keep working your mind to keep your body strong. There are about 43 to choose from. There's a cancer pack, cancer and chemo, but there's also relaxation, stress reduction, affirmations, ways to keep your mind stimulated to keep the body strong.
To just take a few minutes to be quiet.
Yeah,
and
I really
focus.
Believe in it. Yeah.
Yeah, I do too.
I believe in all the adjuvant things, acupuncture, Reiki. I think healing is not only chemical. I think first you have to do what you've got to do to stay alive, but I think then you must add all these adjuvant things to your life to make sure you're employing everything you can to stay well.
You mentioned earlier that you did some work with Bernie Siegel.
Mm-hmm. I actually didn't work. He and I met early in his career when his first book came out. I used to be on programs with him often because he was one of the first ones to espouse this, the strength of the mind and healing. So I would do a lot of seminars and conferences with him. It was terrific. But now there are a lot of people doing it. Then you were thought of as a little bit unusual. Now it's not unusual to do all these therapies.
Right, and that it's not a substitute for the Western medicine
approach. It
but
can't
it's
a
good complement to it.
Adjuvant is the word they use. It's
right.
Combination. It's in addition to.
Yeah, add it on.
Yep.
Right, and they're both important because going through chemotherapy or radiation is not an easy path in itself, and you need something to help keep your mind and body strong through that experience.
Right.
What else would you want to say to someone who's just gotten a diagnosis of cancer?
I think the most important thing to say is take a breath and then look inside because you're much stronger than you think you are. It's one of the things this challenge proves. You have many more resources that haven't been tapped. And if you look inside and you take a time out and marshal them, you're going to survive.
That's great. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Delightful to speak with you about this. And
I wish you well.
We wish all of our listeners well. And I wanted to end with another comment from her book. Rena talks about going after the surgery to visit her doctor and have the wound examined and drained and so forth. Finally, she says on page 48, finally he removed the bandages and I had yet another scar on my body. It seemed to me that the history of people's lives can be read from the wrinkles on their faces and the scars on their bodies. The scars on my face I hid with makeup. The new scar I camouflaged with clothes. I decided that a scar was a positive symbol, a sign of another chance. It was a reminder not to waste one day, to live each day as a celebration. I put the reality of the scar into perspective. It became less and less a priority concern. Living and surviving were my priorities. So this has been a wonderful conversation with Rena, and I hope that you will get a copy of her book. Hopefully it's at your public library. Otherwise, you can find a copy on Amazon, and I will put some hints into the handout that goes with this show. So please check powerfulpatient.org and pick up a copy of the handout. Next week, we're going to talk with a young man who's been participating in a wonderful new experiment in nutrition, learning how to live with foods in their natural state, not adulterated by the processing that is going on these days, but truly natural foods that bring out the healing qualities of foods and enhance the healing ability of our own bodies. So that'll be a very interesting discussion next week, and I hope that you will join us for that. And I hope that you've enjoyed our conversation today with Rena, as I have. So this is Joyce Graff reminding you to enjoy life, and in the next week, plan yourself a celebration, a little one, a big one, it's up to you, but celebrate the fact that you are here, you have a chance to live, and enjoy it, enjoy every day. As Rena tells us, don't let one day go by, make sure that your relationships are current, that you have mended fence wherever you need to mend fence, and that you have good, strong relationships to sustain you, and that you can be a sustenance for other people as well. So enjoy your week and plan a celebration, and I hope that you will be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you.